This week's episode is brought to you by the Retail Innovation Conference and Expo.
It's that consumption at its core is a cultural act. Consumption, what we consume, how we style ourselves, how we adorn ourselves, what we drive, where we go, the institutions that we are a part of, the music that we ingest, literature, film, art, television, podcasts, brands and branded products, they all become ways by which we peacock ourselves to the world.
You're listening to Retail Remix, your inside access to candid conversations with the people shaping retail's future. Here's your host, Alicia Esposito.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of the Retail Remix podcast. I'm your host, Alicia Esposito, VP of Content for Retail Touchpoints, and I am so excited to have on the show today Dr. Marcus Collins, marketing professor at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan, and author of the book For the Culture, The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. Marcus, thank you so much for taking the time. It's so good to have you on.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. I'm so excited to be here with you.
And selfishly, I have been digging into this very topic. Anyone who reads Retail Touchpoints knows that I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to pop culture and how culture influences our behaviors. I know it influences my behaviors. So I'm hoping to get into a lot of those things, but also talk about your career and, of course, your keynote at the Retail Innovation Conference coming up June 4th through 6th. So you game? You ready to dig in?
Let's do it.
Awesome. All right. So let's get into the brass tacks of who you are and what you do. So your bio indicates that you are a cultural translator, which is very interesting to me. I was like, huh, what is that? So can you explain to the folks watching, listening, what exactly does that mean? And how does that give you a bit of an advantage as a marketer, as a strategist, and someone who is basically studying what we do and how we behave?
So I think about a cultural translator as one who is able to see the world through lenses that are not their own and make meaning of the world through said lenses, and then be able to communicate said meaning to people who are not from that community, that group, that constituency, such that they're able to see the familiar in the strange. They can see themselves. They can see themselves in a construction of the world that is not native to them, but also is not exemplary of who they are. So I'm sort of like Google Translator. You say a thing, I go, oh, this is what it means. And then I tell the other group, this is what it means. And I typically, historically rather, have done that for brands, right? Brands want to tap into or engage a certain community of people, certain collective of people that are connected through a shared belief, shared cultural characteristics that govern what they do and how they show up in the world. So I typically say, oh, let's learn about who these people are, translate it for the brand and say, okay, brand, this is how they see the world. And here's where you have license to engage them in discourse, engage them as a community, and sort of facilitate this back and forth, facilitate the dialogue between the two. And over the course of my career, I've been able to do that more and more, not just with brands and consumers as they were, but also with politicians and constituencies or organizations and their employees or institutions and the community in which they operate. But ultimately, the job is about translating one to the other. And the benefit of that, for me at least, is that we spend so much time thinking that the world is objectively the way it is because of the way we see it, when the world truly is subjective based on our cultural lenses. And having that understanding and the curiosity to explore a world that is not yours has served me well as a practitioner, and it continues to pay dividends as a scholar.
Amazing. And I just want to like dig a little bit deeper into that, because in the world of marketing and retail, there are discussions around segments versus personas versus profiles. So having this cultural lens or perspective, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, allows you to reach this level of depth and context that I think is kind of missing right now in a lot of scenarios. Is that fair to say?
That's perfectly stated. Absolutely. You know, we have learned that the world is heterogeneous, where everyone's different. I mean, even twins mm-hmm. are different. And therefore, we have to segment the market, the act of dividing the market into homogeneous-like groups, right? A heterogeneous market, we divide people into homogeneous-like groups based on characteristics they have in common, in hopes that those characteristics will not only reveal more about who they are, but also create an opportunity for us to connect with them as well based on these characteristics, whether it's an affinity, whether it's a preference, whether it's a usage occasion, or whether it's a certain benefit that people crave. And the idea is that if we segment the market into these homogeneous-like clusters, we can then identify the clusters that are more likely to move, more likely to buy, more likely to shop, more likely to vote, more likely to download, more likely to watch, more likely to take action based on these characteristics. And then we position ourselves, either the brand or the branded product, in such a way that speaks to those connections in a compelling fashion. The challenge, to your point that you so eloquently articulated, is that the manner in which we have described people just woefully describes who they are with any sort of accuracy, right? We typically segment based on demographics, age, race, gender, household income, geography, even language, right? These descriptions, these characteristics, while they may be statistically accurate, depending, I mean, like, the money you make is the money you make, right? It is. Your age is your age. Some would argue that gender is fluid, but by and large, you know, those things are somewhat fixed, if you will, at least money, geography, et cetera. But while those things may be descriptive of who we are, they certainly don't accurately describe who we are, right? Like if I said, hey, Alicia, I'm going to set you up with my friend. He's a millennial. Then you go, okay.
Yeah. What else?
Enjoy. It doesn't help you at all. Yeah. Right? And if we require more detail with a potential first date, why wouldn't we require more detail when we're investing millions of dollars to reach people? When we're literally betting the farm in hopes that people will move. So we know demographics are just woefully unprepared to describe people. So we typically go, well, let's focus on psychographics,
yeah.
like their interests, their behavior, their disposition, their attitudes. And that's far better, right? Totally. But here's where it gets interesting, which you alluded to so well, is that our interests, our behaviors, our proclivities, our idiosyncratic practices, they are all byproducts of our cultural subscription. Mm. What we wear, what we like, what we listen to, what we eat, where we vacation, who we marry, if we marry, where we go to school, how we bury the dead, if we bury the dead, all these acts, all these, every aspect of daily living, of social engagement is informed by, dare I say, governed by our cultural subscription. So much so that our psychographics that we typically hold up as sort of the apex, the pinnacle of segmentation is actually a byproduct of our culture. Which says to me then, if we understand people's cultural subscription, not only will we better describe who they are, they'll also be more predictable of what they're likely to do. And as marketers, especially in retail, good night, our job is to get people to move. And culture is the most powerful vehicle that we have to do that.
Yeah. And I think this ties really nicely to the work that you've done in, obviously you've done work in tech, but also in the music industry. And full disclosure, I minored in music business. So I'm a bit of a music geek here. So we're gonna dig a little bit in. So you've done work with iTunes and Nike on their initiative, and you ran digital strategy for the one and only Beyonce. And I just think it speaks to, so you're talking about the cultural connection. I feel like your cultural subscription influences the music communities and music cultures you subscribe to, and vice versa, probably, right? And I guess
that's right.
My question for you is, because I'm all about exploring the intersections and the alignments between these different worlds, like what can brands, retail businesses kind of take from the music industry, which, you know, these artists do such a great job of connecting with the culture, connecting with the communities that subscribe to that culture. And in some cases, like Beyonce, for instance, I feel like build their own cultures, right? It's pretty incredible what they're capable of doing, especially in this digital world. So are there any through lines, lessons that you think really stand out from this work that you've been able to do?
Yes, I would say that music is a cultural expression, right? The literature refers to it as cultural production. It's the shared works of a community that's reflective of the beliefs and ideologies that the community has. So music not only is an expression of who we are, but they're also a reflection of who we are. So the music I listen to are typically a refrain of my worldview. And they also introduce what are the expectations of people like me. And therefore, this cyclic relationship, this, you know, this circuitous relationship between music and consumer becomes a way by which we not only validate, but we also institute what people like us do. And I think that the brands who understand this, whether you are a retail brand or, to your point, an artist, they realize that when you are operating as a cultural product, you are essentially transcending the category in which you reside. For instance, Beyoncé is an artist. She's a singer. She's a dancer. She's a performer. She's also an actress. But let's just say in the world of music. But that's just what Beyoncé does. Beyoncé has transcended being a musical artist. She is what we say an icon. And what is an icon? An icon is a representation of something. It means something. She means more than her music. Her music is a reflection of who she is. It is cultural production of the ideals and the beliefs in which she signifies. So when people who are like, I'm a diehard Beyoncé fan, it's not just because of her songs. Let's give them a name. When the Beehive says, oh, I'm part of the Hive, it's not just because I'm a fan of Beyoncé. Like, no. I subscribe my identity to this because I believe and see the world the way she does. And how does she see the world? She believes in women's empowerment. We've known that since we heard, no. Can you pay my bills? I'm a survivor. To the left, put a ring on it. Who runs the world, girls, to get information? You ain't gonna break my soul, right? Everything that Beyoncé has espoused has been an expression of what she represents and how she sees the world. The best brands transcend their category as well. They're not just a place where I go buy things. They actually become a reflection of my identity. Mm-hmm. Right? That's why people go like, oh, I'm a Costco member.
Yep.
So much so that they wear Kirkland gear, a private label gear, as a way of signaling their identity. And this is what I think, this is sort of where the rubber meets the road.
Right.
It's that consumption at its core is a cultural act. Consumption, what we consume, how we style ourselves, how we adorn ourselves, what we drive, where we go, the institutions that we are a part of, the music that we ingest, literature, film, art, television, podcasts, brands and branded products, they all become ways by which we peacock ourselves to the world, that we signal who we are to the world. And when the brand is consecrated and it's beyond just the thing that I buy, the shirt that I wear, or the airline that I fly, or the burgers that I eat, or where I consume, these things become expressions of my identity. They become outward expressions of who I am on the inside. I mean, that's why people don't call Target Target. They call it Target because it's fancier than just Target. No. It's Target, right? And this nomenclature become ways by which we refashion and rework which is just a superstore. It's a supermarket, right? It's a superstore, to refashion it to be something much, much more because it means more meaning. Culture is a meaning-making system, and we use culture to help make meaning of the world around us. Taking things that are messy, which this world is a mess, doesn't have any inherent meaning, but we look at it and give it meaning. And much like brands, the best artists in the world, the most powerful artists, the ones that stand the test of time, they mean something beyond their art, because their art is a reflection of who they are and how they see the world.
Amazing.
Are you ready to explore the evolved customer journey where content, community, and commerce converge? At the Retail Innovation Conference and Expo, you'll learn how brands and retailers are embracing new consumer insights, new technologies, and new destinations to create relevant and resonant experiences. Taking place on June 4th through the 6th at McCormick Place in Chicago, the Retail Innovation Conference and Expo will bring some of the brightest minds in the industry together for unique networking and learning opportunities, including keynote speaker, marketing expert, and author of For the Culture, Marcus Collins. Check out the show notes to register today.
I feel like I could ask so many follow-up questions, but I have a list of questions that I actually need to ask. So let's follow through because I want to get into like the heart behind your book. And, you know, you've had such great experience working in music, tech, you know, working for agencies. I'm curious, you know, what was the activation point for you that said like, yes, I need to do a book on this because this thing was missing. And I'm not seeing this being really discussed when we talk about commerce, marketing strategy, brand strategy. Was it just simply the cultural connection and how deep it goes? Or was there something else that you thought was a really significant gap in the market?
I felt like there was an anemia in the market with the way in which we use language. And I felt that I was guilty just as much as anyone else in the market, anyone else in our industry, rather. We talk about culture all the time. Let's get our ideas out in the culture. What's happening in culture? Culture, 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 culture. But our ability to describe culture, to define it with any modicum of concreteness is very, very, very thin. And I found myself saying things like, you know, the most powerful brands, they lead culture, culture, this, culture, that, you know, what's going on in culture. But I didn't really know what I was talking about. I mean, I knew it instinctively. I knew it intuitively. But if you asked me to describe it, you would have got a Homer Simpson blank stare from me. Or I would have just had like a whole bunch of buzzwords and jargon, which is typically what we use when we are absent of understanding of a construct. And while this is happening, I was endeavoring myself into the social sciences. I was like working my way into academia, having been in practice all of my career. So you're starting to explore this world of academia. And in the academy, there is a unbelievable emphasis on language. Like we don't use synonyms. No. Like you say what you mean and you mean what you say. And we split hairs about what a word is and what it means, about the definition of a word. And I'd find myself sort of in a sort of purgatory that I'm operating in a world of academia where there's such great meticulousness about the language that we use. And then being in the world of marketing, but we make up words.
Yeah.
It's like invent words. Like, what is that?
That's not a real thing. Yeah.
Of course we do. So I said, you know, I think that the practicing world could benefit from some concreteness. And I believe that we really needed a Rosetta Stone, a better Rosetta Stone to talk about culture, especially considering how influential culture is to who we are, what we do, and how we navigate social life. And I felt like this was a book worth writing, not just to help people be better at their jobs, but even more so, I thought it was a book that was worth writing because I thought it could help us be just better human beings, better neighbors with regards to this planet that we cohabitate.
I love that. And I think there's something to be said about being, like you're talking about how you say what you mean, you mean what you say, you're very concrete about word choice in academia. And I think there's something to be said about being intentional about the words you say, understanding the context behind the words we say and how that actually turns into something that you put out into the world. So that definitely resonated. And I guess since we're talking about defining things, understanding what they mean, how they're applied, there's this idea of cultural proximity, right? And I'm curious, like how can we dig a little bit deeper into that? Can you help us understand what that means and how that's kind of driven the evolution of brands and their attachment to consumers and vice versa, right?
Yeah. So cultural proximity, let's unpack each word. So culture is a system of conventions and expectations that demarcate who we are and govern what people like us do. It's a system. It's made up of these mechanisms that govern how we inform how we see the world and govern how we navigate through it. Proximity is about closeness. So we talk about cultural proximity. It's how close are we to understanding the conventions and expectations of a given group of people. So cultural proximity is our ability to look at something and go, oh, I know what that means, as opposed to I see what I observe, right? But I know what that means. And meaning is mediated by our cultural lenses. So therefore, I have to understand how you see the world such that when I observe something, I go, to me, that may look crazy, but I get it because for them, it's X, Y, and Z. And which I think is the humbling part about studying culture is that you can look at a group of people and go, they nuts. And the same filter or the same evaluative measurement that you use to judge other people, they can judge you similarly. You go, like, you nuts that you do X, Y, and Z. And it seems so concrete because it's our lives, because it's our world that we've manifested in our minds. But it's just as subjective and messy and nonsensical and illogical as someone else's conception of reality. So for brands who want to engage in culture, you know, we have to first have proximity. We have to get close to it. And first we ask, well, whose culture are we talking about? Because there's many, 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 many cultures. And then say, okay, well, what are the cultural characteristics, what Durkheim refers to as the social facts of this given group of people that informs how they see the world and ultimately how they navigate it? And then we ask ourselves, so how do we be a part of it? And that level of sort of scrutiny, or maybe said differently, that level of interrogation comes from sitting in a place of humility, that it's not what can I take, but what can I give? And we can only give good gifts if you understand, right? You know, like when I buy a gift for my wife for Christmas or for her birthday, you have to think about, like, what does Alex really want? What does she get? Like, it requires closeness, right? And when I nail the gift, it's because I got all the nuances. I've been paying attention. And she goes, oh man, you heard what I said, that, oh, thank you. And that seems so simple because we know it intuitively as social animals. But the minute we put our business hat on, we forget what it means to be human. And as a result, we find ourselves growing further apart than more proximal.
Mm-hmm. So to that end, are there any brands that you have seen achieve this level of proximity and do a really good job of it? I mean, I have my own ideas, but I'm curious if any have really stuck out to you. Like you mentioned Costco and Kirkland, but any others?
Yeah. The one that comes to mind for me always, this is the apex of it all for me, is Patagonia. I mean, Patagonia knows who they are. They know exactly who they are. And because they know who they are, they have a very clear compass of how to show up in the world and to know who they're for, right? They're for people who see the world the way they do. Like, we believe this. We believe in minimizing our invasiveness on the planet, right? We believe in climbing clean, as Yvon Chouinard puts it. And you go, that's what we're servicing. Now, you may buy our clothes and fine, sure, great, you know, totally. We're not going to say no to your money unless we know explicitly that you don't see the world the way we do. But like, you know, hey, we're not going to stop you from buying the gear. But our products, our messaging, our retail environment, everything that we do, it is curated based on how we see the world for people who see the world like us. And they understand the cultural characteristics of what it means to be a part of this community because they are actively a part of it. They're not tangentially looking over the shoulder like, what's cool over there? What's happening over there? They're not looking for trends. They're looking for understanding and finding ways to communicate in ways that are expressive of their shared beliefs. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, no, really great example. And I think, you know, looking at the other side of the coin, so to speak, there are some brands that try to achieve that level of brand engagement, of really deep understanding, creating that immersion, so to speak, right? Like you said, the consumers are in it, right? Then that means they're in the experience, they're in with the brand, they're in for the long run, right? Which I think every brand or retailer is trying to achieve nowadays. But as we think about culture and being a part of the culture, or, you know, being in the zeitgeist, right? Like that's like the new thing, right? Like with the phenomenon around the Barbie movie, right? Everyone wanna be in the zeitgeist, be in the Barbie zeitgeist. Which ones have like totally missed the point or maybe didn't get the point quite right? I mean, we don't wanna pick on anyone, but maybe more diplomatically, maybe we can discuss where things have gone wrong, things to look out for. That way it feels a bit more actionable and valuable for the listeners.
Yeah. So not to incriminate the guilty, you know, I'd say that the brands, the organizations, institutions that have misstep are the brands and organizations, institutions that have focused on the expressions and not the meaning. That is, they saw the kids do this. So go, we're going to do our version of that too. Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, please stop. please stop. Because we can observe a thing and mimic it. And mimicry is essentially cosplay. But when we observe a thing and we understand it, we then contribute to it. And this is where brands have the best opportunity to engage in culture, is to contribute to it, to contribute new perspective, contribute new points of view, contribute new beliefs, new behaviors, language, and artifacts. At the very least, engage or participate in the ones that already exist by having a point of view. But the brands, the organizations, institutions who just jump in on the trend because the trend is hot, you look like the meme. How are you doing, my fellow millennials? Like, that's what you
literally going to bring that up. That is so funny. You're in my head. I get it.
I mean, and that's what it looks like. You go, man, please stop. It's, you know, I used to tell clients that, listen, the minute Al Roker starts doing the trend, it's done, fam. It is done. Please don't. And no shade to Al Roker. Love him dearly. But the idea is that the minute that it is being replicated, mimicked by people who you know are not a part of the culture or even have proximity to the culture, you go, oh, this is theater for you. This isn't meaningful. And the idea is that brands are able to be a part of culture when they have a point of view that is full of meaning, that is meaningful. They either contribute new characteristics or they participate in the characteristics that exist because they have a proximal understanding that allowed them to say something meaningful in the discourse.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I understand the allure of trying to just get on the trend, right? Especially from the marketer's perspective, right? There's this pressure to be a part of the conversation. Are we trending? Are we showing up in the algorithm? Are we in the mix, right? Because they have managers, executive leaders that are looking at those things as indicators for success. But at the same time, they know they need to be authentic. They need to be human to human with their consumers, right? Like, they're feeling all of this pressure to, you know, hit those marks and be able to connect with consumers in a more intimate level. But that takes time, right? That takes work. That takes strategy. And sometimes it works. Sometimes the metrics aren't what they're supposed to be or what people expect them to be. It seems like there's a bit of a tug of war happening, I guess, when it comes to this art of marketing and art of brand strategy. And I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are on this tug of war that's happening, what it means, and how teams can really navigate this and ensure that they are focusing on this connection with the consumer in the most authentic and intentional way, going back to that word, intentional way that they possibly can.
Again, so well said. The tension at play is a misalignment of time horizons, that relationships, to your point, require time. There is no such thing as an efficient relationship. It requires time. You know, if your friend goes on a date and comes back and says, it was our first date, we had the time of our lives, I'm engaged, you go, oh, it ain't gonna work. Because we know that relationships take time. We know that trust takes time. You know, intimacy takes time. It doesn't happen overnight, quite literally. But marketers are being forced to build relationships and get married in a quarter's time. Where the quarter say, we look at the quarter. In some cases, people are looking at the stocks every day, every hour, right? And thanks to the transparency that we get from the zeros and ones from digital metrics, we go second by second. Is it moving? Is it happening? How many likes? How many followers? How many retweets? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So those the transparency that we're given with regards to measurement has reduced the time horizon by which we expect the work to work, but yet we still want relationships. Therefore, we end up over-investing in transactional exchanges and mistaking those for relationships. People continue to buy from us. They love us. Not always, actually. Some of that is just habitual behavior, right? Love takes time. Lightweight interactions over a period of time. So the idea then is that you got to nurture the fruit tree while you eat the fruit because you need to eat, right? But you can't just nurture and never eat, only about the long-term time horizon. And you can't eat all the fruit without it giving time to grow, only thinking about the transactional. Bonet and Fields, their work with the IPA showed that, look, short-term and long-term, the combination of the two is how we maximize profits. And that's what we need to get to. We have to have some patience with a bit of urgency. But realizing that what we're measuring in the short run are exchanges, but what we're building are relationships, and that can only be measured in the long run.
Very interesting. There's some nuance there that I'm sure is a lot to unpack for certain people, right? Because we have seen instances where there's a really big campaign going out, it's in the market for a few weeks, and then you see a big marketing change up, right? I'm not going to name names, but it leads to questions around, like, was there full alignment here? Like, do they understand the vision and intention that's happening here? But I know we're going to get into a lot of this, or you're going to get into a lot of this more specifically during the Retail Innovation Conference in Chicago this June. For the folks out there that are curious, anything else you can share around what they can expect, you know, what's to come from your talk?
We're going to get in pretty deep. The hope is to get going pretty deep and explore this world of culture that is so vast, but we're going to explore it with a scalpel. We're going to be very precise with how we talk about these things, see it in different categories so we can see how it manifests and that it's not sort of one-dimensional. But most importantly, the hope is that attendees walk out with not only perspective, but they walk out with some skill. That because they see the world different, they go, oh, I know how to apply this directly to my business. That's the hope.
Awesome. We love to hear that. But for now, that is it for us. We're out of time. I know you're a very busy man, but Dr. Marcus Collins, thank you so much, sir, for taking the time out to chat with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And to all of you, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Drop us a line on social, leave us a rating or review on your preferred podcast player. But I know our entire team is super excited to hear Dr. Marcus Collins again and get that scalpel out during the Retail Innovation Conference and Expo this June in Chicago. But for now, that's it from us, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you next time. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Retail Remix. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find us on your favorite podcast player. Until next time, keep mixing it up.